You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining me today as I'm in conversation with Manny Alvarez. Manny, thanks for joining. Really excited to talk about cryptocurrency, regulation, and all the interesting things to come. Manny is currently the founding principal of Bridge Council Strategies. He previously served as the commissioner for the California Department of Business Oversight, California's banking and financial regulatory agency. He led the transition of the department to the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation, focusing on protecting consumers from harmful practices, increasing access to financial literacy and technology, and engaging with underserved communities. Before that, Manny served as general counsel and chief compliance officer of a firm, a fintech company, leading the legal and regulatory efforts there. My name is Lonnie Mahanta. I am a non-resident fellow here at Brookings in the Center on Regulations and Market, part of the series around reimagining modern day markets and regulation. So, you know, appropriate topic for us here. I'm also the vice president of public policy and government relations at Zillow. And full disclosure, Manny and I were law school classmates, what feels like many, many moons ago. So Manny, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Lonnie, for inviting me. And it's a real pleasure to be here with you.
All right, well, let's jump in. So we'll start with some basic questions here. You know, there's a lot of different folks that are joining today, different levels of background understanding around what cryptocurrency is in the first instance. So why don't we kind of just start there? Can you explain for the layman what cryptocurrency is?
Certainly, give it my best college try. So cryptocurrency is a currency, a thing of value that is represented by a digital asset. And that digital asset resides on a decentralized network called the blockchain. And depending on the protocol, the particular cryptocurrency will be verified either by some third party or a series of third parties or some other state. That is probably the best I can do in terms of providing a layperson's definition of cryptocurrency. But the reality, I think, is that especially as new protocols continue to emerge, the reality is that that definition, I think, will continue to slip and morph. And I think that actually lends itself to, or that's kind of the crux of a lot of the difficulties that we see and that we're going to be talking about in terms of how you regulate this thing.
Yep. Yeah, of course. I mean, that's, where these things go and how we regulate based on what exists today versus in addition to sort of what's coming down the road, I think it's going to be an interesting question as these issues progress. A couple more baseline questions for you. You mentioned blockchain. What is blockchain? Is it, you know, how do we think about what a blockchain is? And is it the same thing as a distributed ledger technology? How does that interact with cryptocurrency? How should we think about that?
So again, major caveat, I'm not myself a technologist. So if people want to tell me that I'm a moron, I welcome the feedback. But I do think of blockchain as a decentralized ledger, as a decentralized database that, that lives everywhere. And the way I think about how a blockchain interacts with the cryptocurrency, that asset resides on the blockchain itself. I'm glad you've pulled apart the two concepts because one of the, I think one of the areas that is worth exploring is what other applications might blockchain technology have that are independent from cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. And I'll actually just make a little note here. Some of the people that have joined us today pre-submitted a few questions. And so I'll be interspersing those throughout. And one of the questions that came up, and we can try to get to it a little bit later, but one of the questions that came up was about different applications and use of blockchain technology that might be distinct from, you know, cryptocurrency itself. One more, this is sort of just nomenclature, and I'm speaking as sort of a person that's just, you know, just been reading and trying to learn and understand. Another couple other terms that I hear thrown out: crypto wallets, crypto exchanges. What are those? How much do I need to understand what that is, what those products or terms are in trying to understand cryptocurrency?
Yeah, I think, so shockingly, I think both of those terms are probably, I think it's okay to be seduced by the self-explanatory inclination of those two terms. Crypto wallet is simply the means by which you hold cryptocurrency. It could be a hot wallet, meaning it's plugged into a network. It is actively plugged into one of the chains, mm-hmm. Or cold storage. You're taking that currency off of a network and storing it on a device, a thumb drive or some other device that's not plugged into a network. And then an exchange is, you know, I think of it as simply a type of market where digital assets can be exchanged, bought, sold, for either fiat currency or other forms of cryptocurrencies.
Okay. So for the perhaps crypto evangelists out there, what are the biggest opportunities with crypto? What does it offer? Why are we, you know, why is it so much a part of our conversation these days?
Why do we care?
Yeah.
You know, I think that answer will depend on who you're asking. And so let me offer up a survey of perspectives that I've kind of coalesced over time. So these are not necessarily perspectives that I share, but I think it's fair to say that this is kind of a survey of opinions out there. So in the earliest days, it seemed that a lot of what the hardcore crypto evangelists were embracing involved the anonymous nature of cryptocurrency and the decentralized nature of cryptocurrency. Actually, I should have used air quotes in both cases, because as time has progressed, as things have evolved, neither one of those two states is really all that true across the board. It really is not the case that you have a purely anonymous technology represented by cryptocurrency. It really is not the case, or it is the notion of a fully decentralized ledger, I think, is increasingly challenged as kind of the locus of computing power and technology continues to be concentrated in various pockets. So those, I think, were two at least early impulses, early perspectives that the hardcore evangelists shared. Relatedly, I think, again, some of the early acolytes believed that this represented, this was a good move away from centralized monetary institutions. I do not trust X, Y, and Z government. I do not, and by extension, I do not trust that government's fiat currency. I do trust, however, this newfangled currency. So I think those were kind of some of the early perspectives, you know, the libertarian perspective that I'm going to call. And then, you know, there are other perspectives that are perhaps more practical, less radical, I think. One practical use case that I think is incredibly fair, actually, has to do with the the ability to move a thing of value, the ability to move money while reducing network costs, right? Mm-hmm. Today, to move money from institution to institution, there are all of these intermediaries that take slices of money along the way. And cryptocurrency, at least there is the potential to disintermediate that value chain and pass those savings on to consumers. I think the technology has yet to fully realize that that promise, but that at least to my mind seems like an important practical application, particularly as we're talking about cross-border transactions, right? Where sending money to a relative in Mexico today is perhaps costlier than it could be. And then we get into a host of other applications, I think, that are still being plumbed. They're still being kind of discovered. So one is there's the notion of using cryptocurrency to unlock the value of a host of different things, right? Of a product or of a person or of a brand. I think that notion, right, of kind of a proprietary token that represents value in a person, place, or idea. I think that probably will continue to take place. And then getting away from the notion of kind of the monetization, there are other practical applications that at least some people have been excited about. And I don't think we've really seen these fully come to fruition. But there's the smart contract application, right? So the idea that you can have things other than just digital asset or cryptocurrencies riding on blockchains. You can have smart contracts, right? So there are at least a handful of examples of products where you can kind of store a contract on top of the blockchain, and there is actually some value there because you have a transaction that is fully digitally native in the mortgage space, for example. Mm-hmm. It may be easier to to securitize kind of a mortgage that is represented on a blockchain. And then finally, the last perspective that I'll share, at least some people are excited by applications in, for example, corporate governance, right? So for proxy voting and things like that, right? Mm. Does blockchain present an opportunity, an elegant solution to that kind of need to communicate across the board with a lot of different stakeholders, shareholders, things of that nature?
That's great. It's really helpful to kind of think about the broad applications. And I think implicitly you answered one of the questions that an audience member submitted, which was, been paying attention for the last few years and can't find any reason for cryptocurrencies except to meet the needs of ransomware criminals, the whims of Banana Republic presidents, and the impulses of people who would be better off betting on horses. So I think that there's a fair amount of skepticism and criticism from some places, but there's also a possibility perhaps of beneficial applications that we haven't even fully come to fruition just yet. But some of the concerns, I think, are probably relevant in the questions around regulation. So let's kind of move over to that area. There's a lot of talk about crypto being in a regulatory gray area. The IRS classifies crypto as property. The CFTC considers crypto a commodity. The SEC has said that digital assets maybe securities, depending on the facts and the circumstances. Having sat in the role of California's top financial regulator, where do you see crypto fitting into the existing regulatory framework?
This is the I suspect that this question and riffs on this question will be in, dreaded and incredible law school exam questions for years to come. Because the answer is, it depends, right? Mm-hmm. How is it regulated? How well is it regulated?
The lawyer's favorite answer anyway. So yeah,
exactly. So part of the problem, in my view, it's a definitional problem, as I think folks have surmised. When I hear the way my ear is tuned, when I hear people talk about the regulation of cryptocurrency, to me, that's akin to saying something like the regulation of heat or, the regulation of water. Well, in what form and in what application, right? So I think the first step is we need to kind of drop one or two levels below and talk about the function that we're concerned about, right? Are we focusing on the stored value function or nature of this technology? Are we focusing on the function that behaves like an investment vehicle, right? Once we kind of address that taxonomy problem, then I think you can get into what regulations and what regulators apply here. So, for example, when I was commissioner in California, we had at least a handful of existing licensees. Whether they were depository institutions like a bank or a credit union, or a non-depository institution like maybe a mortgage bank or a money transmitter, any number of licensees would ask us, "Hey, can I do this thing in the cryptocurrency space within the bounds of my existing authority, within the bounds of my existing license," right? So some banks, for example, want to know, hey, can we use crypto technology to help reduce our exchange fees when interacting with other, either transmitting money internally or externally. And in some cases, it was pretty clear to us at the department that, yeah, the technology is facilitating certain authorities that you already have as a result of your bank charter or your credit union license. So sure. I do think that states, let me just stick with states for a second. I do think that states have a role to play in the regulation of cryptocurrency, and that many states have been playing that role, oftentimes without much fanfare or understanding by the public, right? Because it's part of the confidential relationship between state regulator and licensee. But that has been happening, and I suspect will continue to happen.
Let me bring a different lens, or maybe it's sort of a riff from what you're talking about here, what the application is. So when you were at the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation, one of the, themes I think you were focusing on was around consumer protection and protecting consumers. What aspect? So there's a part of what you just articulated that is around existing authority of a bank to sort of, perhaps muddle around the edges. It matters for them from a compliance perspective, perhaps not super visible for a consumer. Is there a component of this that, really was about consumer protection? And what are the types of things that a regulator might be thinking about protecting against in that, that framework?
Absolutely. There's a huge, in my view, there's a huge consumer protection component here. And going back to your earlier, the question that you read off earlier in your comment, there are absolutely concerns that I think are well founded, right? So there is the need to protect consumers to ensure that basics, right? That their funds are not stolen by somebody, by a nameless, faceless technology. I mean, that's a really, really scary thing, right? I deposit my fiat currency, or I convert my fiat currency into this thing that exists in decentralized fashion. Who's responsible for making sure that it's there at the end of the day, et cetera, right? And so there's the impulse and the need to ensure that that a consumer's funds are safeguarded, that they are there, that they are there when they should be there. Then there's kind of the investor protection, the quote investor protection component, right? To the extent that we want to make the one-to-one comparison, or at least analogize to investable assets. There is, you know, at least an impulse to protect investors from the volatility of this asset class. And for the record, I should say, I'm not someone who believes that volatility in and of itself is problematic, right? There are plenty of asset classes that are incredibly volatile. The trick is to make sure that that the capital that is flowing into that kind of volatile asset class knows what it's getting into, right? So we're talking about everything from disclosure-based regimes to everything else, to kind of product experience. So there's a, you know, look, there's a huge consumer protection concern here, or at least there should be. And the good news is, look, I don't believe any of those concerns. I don't think it's rocket science, right? The problem, getting back to kind of where we started with this question, part of the problem has been there are plenty of regulators with a lot of different tools that they can bring to bear to achieve similar or the same consumer protection, investor protection outcomes. The problem is, how do you know who's in the game, right? How do you know who's on duty? And I think that's been part of the issue that we're trying to figure out. Well, whose responsibility is it, right? The states have been playing a role. Should they continue to play the exclusive role? Probably not. Who at the federal government should be mining the store? And is it their exclusive jurisdiction? Why or why not? So I think those are the questions, right? Who's in charge here? That have made the regulation of this all pretty tricky.
I want to dig in more on that, but before we move to that, I've just, you know, philosophical question here. The volatility of the asset class is also where a lot of the upside might exist. There seems to be some tension around protecting consumer protection, protecting individuals who are perhaps not knowledgeable about like what they're getting into, but also our other side is like democratization and giving access to people who perhaps did not have access, were not meeting other standards of who a qualified investor is, or, you know, the rules around who is allowed to kind of access those types of asset classes or investment opportunities. How do you, personal level or former commissioner, Pat, whatever, how do you view that? And is that even a tension?
I absolutely think that there's tension there. And my personal philosophy, you know, my personal philosophy here and probably just about any other financial technology we talk about, I think I like the impulse. I like the directional movement toward democratization of this kind of technology, of these kinds of products, of these kinds of tools, as long as it's accompanied by serious and intentional focus on the education component, right? So I think, you know, personally, I think it's problematic that here again, right, we have an area where there's a cottage industry of hedge funds springing up, making handsome sums of money because they're able to bring to bear, cutting edge technology, taking advantage of small swings in crypto prices, making a ton of money, right, as a sophisticated investor, and that's fine. They should continue to do that. But I would also hope that we could find a way to unlock that value for the retail investor, particularly particularly those that have been historically shut out of, you know, these sorts of products and services. Easy to say, hard to do. I mean, because I think plenty of people might conclude, well, this simply is not an appropriate asset class for many, perhaps most retail investors. I understand that instinct. I think there's merit to that perspective. It's just not necessarily one that I share, right? My view is, no, we can do better. We can actually make these products and services available to a lot of retail investors, but we have to commit ourselves to education and to teaching them what this is about. I mean, look, I have similar feelings about, again, these are personal feelings. I have similar feelings about this in like the cannabis space, right? Where it was illegal for in California for so long, and you locked up so many, you know, men of color for petty possession cases. And now all of a sudden there's a, you know, a cottage industry of cannabis companies that are getting rich because of the newly legalized status. That just doesn't sit well with me. I can probably analogize those feelings across the board to a lot of different areas and technologies.
Yeah. One more thought sort of just on this general regulation. When you were sitting in the role as commissioner, were you focused more around regulation specifically on cryptocurrency, or was there a focus also on blockchain and blockchain applications, or was that an area that was like a slightly less regulated, at least in the early days?
Our entry point at the department was kind of twofold. One, are we discharging? Are we as a regulator discharging our duty to protect consumers and investors and make sure that sensible safeguards exist, right? And so I suppose that applies more in the crypto lens, right? Less in the blockchain and the blockchain conversation per se. But then also, you know, at least when I was commissioner, I viewed our mandate as helping to promote and facilitate responsible innovation. Some of what I've been talking about. I do not believe that the right answer should be to throw up your hands and say, well, it's too hard. It probably means that you shouldn't, that the retail consumer investor should not have access to this. So we spent a lot of time also proactively engaging with companies to better understand, you know, what are the potentially valuable applications of the blockchain technology that you're talking about, and what are some of the ways that we can help? And if we don't have a role to play here, then, you know, we should probably tell you. But I definitely viewed my prior role as at least in part helping to promote and facilitate that kind of responsible innovation.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the questions that I have for you and your thoughts around the state government role in regulation and the federal government's role in regulation. And I mention that in part because we've seen the federal government under this administration take a seemingly much more interest in crypto. You know, a couple of recent examples, there was an SEC letter regarding a lending product from Coinbase. Crypto was raised in the SEC chair's confirmation hearing. Some things that were really critical to the crypto space were tucked into the infrastructure bill. So there's a lot of stuff that's happening right now. One of the complaints that we've heard from some of the companies in the space are they've been trying to get more information and outreach with the SEC, and they're not having that engagement. So a lot in there. But let's just start with, you know, what is the role? How do you view about what the role is of states in regulating cryptocurrency versus what is properly the domain or more appropriately the domain of the federal government regulatory involvement?
You know, I think it's a tough question to answer. I think states have long been playing a role in the crypto space and will likely continue playing a role in the crypto space. I would also, you know, I think I can also safely share that states would like to see, I think it is good for everyone when the federal government clearly articulates its, you know, baseline expectations, whether it's baseline expectations coming out of the SEC or CFTC or what have you. But I think, even state regulators probably have historically shared in some of this frustration, I'll call, by reticence at all levels, including the federal government. It's hard to coordinate this kind of patchwork of state by state regulation when the answer that you keep getting, right, from at least certain federal agencies is either it depends or, you know, we'll get back to you. That's tough. So in a lot of ways, I think it's good that the federal government is leaning into this with renewed vigor. The best time to have gotten involved from a regulatory standpoint was always yesterday. And the next best time to get involved is today. There is a concern. I think there is a general concern about gotcha style regulation, right? We never told you that this was our expectation, but now we're telling you this is our expectation, and we're going to ding you because
and you're in violation.
that's a tough framework, right? That's a tough framework to operate in.
And like coming from a company perspective, I'll throw out the company perspective here. It is hard. It's hard to not having necessarily in the financial tech space, but generally a company that is trying to navigate the patchwork of state laws. You'll hear that term thrown out a lot, but it is like, you know, you're trying to build a business with rules and regulations that are not consistent. It is a much more clear process when there is consistency across, which almost always requires federal engagement. But also clear rules. You know, it is difficult from a trying to manage compliance when the rules are not clear. It's a little bit fact-based. We'll see how case law turns out. We'll see how things turn out. A lot of organizations want to be following the rules, but need to know what the rules are in order to do so.
I agree. And I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but I think when I first assumed responsibility as commissioner, a lot of people asked, well, what perspective is he going to bring? Is he going to bring the private industry fintech perspective, or is he going to bring the consumer protection perspective from his enforcement days? And the answer is yes, yes to all of the above. I mean, you don't. This is why when I, for example, would look to fill out the leadership team at the department, I love that kind of diversity of perspective because I understand you don't bring a single lens to the role, right? You bring all the ones you got, and I think. I think there is, my personal feeling is there is this unfortunate skepticism that goes kind of both ways, right? Where some regulators believe that that all companies are simply trying to skirt regulation, and you know, from firsthand experience, I just don't believe that to be true. I think are there bad actors? Sure, mm-hmm. absolutely. And they are bad for everyone, right? They're also bad for other companies that are trying to do the right thing, right? And I can speak from firsthand experience that it can be frustrating for companies that are trying to do the right thing, but they don't know what that is, or they at least don't have clarity. And you know, when they try their level best to kind of intuit what that might be, it can be tough, right? To be told after the fact, well, no, that wasn't exactly true. That wasn't exactly the right thing. So absolutely. And yet we never lose, or, you know, it's not like I lose sight of the need for consumer protection. You absolutely need sensible guardrails.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that, and there's also a perspective out there just around like, well, the good, people should be self-regulating and acting from, just doing the right thing on their own. My personal perspective is like that, while there are plenty of entities that are trying to do the right thing, that is certainly not sufficient for most of these things. You need to have an externally enforced regulatory infrastructure so that you are at least creating an even playing field for all the market entrants, at least to the extent that you can.
I mean, look, my 7-year-old does his homework because he knows that someone's going to check it, right? I mean, if you didn't have that threat, well, why would he?
Okay, but I guess another question though, crypto has not been around for all that long. Do you have any concerns around regulation being put in place today that will stifle a nascent industry? How do you think about regulating for the technology as it exists today, but versus where it might be in 20 years and how hard it is to change the rules down the road?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, look, in my view, I think the answer has to involve deeper collaboration, frankly, between industry and the regulator, but real two-way, real collaboration that's kind of that's a two-way street. I share some of these concerns about losing out on good practical applications of blockchain technology because of unintended consequences. I mean, for example, right? Like I do think there are probably really useful applications in the corporate governance space, and people are excited about it, and yet we're not really seeing it. I don't know why, but I absolutely would be concerned about stifling a useful application of a technology because we tried to overcorrect, over here. My view is the kind of two-way dialogue that has been emerging over a couple of years. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that this doesn't exist at the state or federal level. It does. But I think it ought to accelerate. We need to embrace that kind of framework. And I think it's important for everyone to get comfortable with the idea that we may not always have all the answers at the outset. Right. This is another tangent, but there is a tangential relation here to what we're talking about. When I was commissioner, I was often asked about sandboxes. Are sandboxes good or sandboxes bad? My personal feeling, now that I can share those personal feelings freely, is that the way that the term sandbox has been politicized.
Can you define the term sandboxes for?
Listen. Well, that's the thing. That's part of the problem, right? The term was politicized without actually talking about what we meant by a sandbox, right? So some people over here would say, well, sandboxes are bad, because I think their view of a sandbox was, oh, this means suspending all rules and regulations and giving industry actors carte blanche to find their product market fit and do whatever. But that doesn't have to be true, right? There are other frameworks, right? There's the type of sandbox that doesn't mean throwing your hands up and giving up. It actually means leaning in more and saying, hey, well, here are our baseline sets of expectations. Why don't we keep talking? Come back in 6 months, come back in 12 months, and we'll check our hypotheses, right? The regulator in the UK, the FCA, the Federal Conduct Authority, they have an innovation function and their notion of a sandbox is exactly this. Their notion of a sandbox is actually more like provisional licensing, right?
Yeah, so, sounds like experimentation, but in close conversation with the regulator and the regulated entity.
Exactly, and I my view is that kind of framework can be really productive and really powerful. But my fear was that, you know, we may have avoided that kind of dialogue because it felt icky, because it felt too much like a sandbox. And again, that's a term.
I think you might have cut out on me. I'm not sure if that is my Wi-Fi or yours. The joys of working from home. Can you hear me, Manny?
I can. Yeah.
Okay, there we go. We're back. All right. You mentioned earlier in our conversation, in institutional players getting more involved in the cryptocurrency space in the last couple of years. What does that say to you? Is that an indication of what's happening and where things are going?
Yeah, I think it indicates that that cryptocurrency itself is likely not going away. When you have the Fidelities of the world piling into Bitcoin and Ethereum as a hedge against inflation, I think that tends to indicate a couple of things. One, it tends to indicate that not all cryptocurrencies are alike, and that's, I'm stating the obvious, right? But not all cryptocurrencies behave in that kind of behave like gold, right? Not every cryptocurrency can anchor a portfolio and hedge against inflation the way perhaps Bitcoin and Ethereum can. And once you have that kind of institutional volume piling into it, it's not going to disappear tomorrow. How could it? Mm-hmm. If anything, it indicates to me the need to really think about regulatory engagement again in this kind of collaborative fashion. I mean, sure. You know, you can take an aggressive approach, and you can start with enforcement actions, but that's not the only framework available to you.
Mm-hmm. You know, you also mentioned something earlier. It's sort of tying to this question about retail investors who has access, institutional players versus the retail investors. There's another maybe analogous or similar lens that we could talk about here, which is sort of who are the winners and losers in the current cryptocurrency movement? And are we replicating some of the previous mistakes around accessibility and what groups of people have access and don't have access?
So that last point in your question, that's my concern, right? Are we I would be concerned about a world in which, I'll just be blunt, in which people of color are left behind from an opportunity to help, get involved, generate wealth, et cetera, et cetera. But I struggle with that as well. I mean, it's not so clear cut in my mind because, and this is where some of my own skepticism comes in. Because there have to be losers in a crypto exchange, I think, because, you don't always have, it's unlike an equity, right? Where you have underlying performance. There's performance of a company underlying the thing. Mm-hmm. This is where my skepticism comes in, right? If you don't have that kind of underlying performance, how can one at the retail level make decisions that are based on anything but momentum? And that's tough. Right. Mm-hmm. So I might be able to take advantage of the volatility of swings in crypto prices because I understand at least a little bit momentum trading, but not everyone does. And that's hard for me to square. Right. I don't know what the answer ought to be. On balance, though, it does feel to me like we should not neglect the opportunity and the duty that we have to ensure that that these kinds of transformational technologies and products are available to everyone.
Yeah, and I think there's also a possibility here where, again, we can pull apart some of the cryptocurrency and also applications of blockchain technology. And it could be that there's, another facet of this conversation around use of blockchain technology in, benefiting communities of color or helping to think about like where there might be opportunities on closing the racial wealth gap. And now, I'll be full disclosure. These were conversations that I've been having at Zillow in my role as head of public policy at Zillow. And I'm going to digress here for a second, but bear with me. I had the opportunity this week, and actually the final things are later this afternoon, but to be a judge in an HBCU hackathon related to Zillow. Historically, black colleges and universities students did a hackathon. So awesome. And several of the students, the groups were focused in thinking about cryptocurrency, but also blockchain technology in the housing market and where it might have applicability there. And so, there were some interesting questions around how blockchain might be beneficially used in mortgages, thinking about perhaps collateral. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I, frankly, I'm like, I can understand the top line and the specifics are not super clear to me. So I'm no expert here, but questions around use of blockchain technology in, perhaps modernizing or reducing fees, if nothing else, in the mortgage and lending space. But also, though, there was some conversation that I'm starting to see around use of blockchain technology in different types of credit scoring. Talking a little bit about access to credit as, the primary way in which people are eligible for mortgages. But of course, there's all kinds of problems with our traditional credit system. You have to bring on debt to even get a credit score in the first place, but that's not actually an indication of like if a new, a new person in the market is a reliable and is likely to kind of make their payments on time. So thinking about entirely different ways of creating, trustworthiness or credit trustworthiness, reputational, bringing in other things. Seems like there's a lot there. Curious if that's something that you've come across or what your thoughts are around those opportunities.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. A couple of thoughts. One is, and this is, I feel like we could do this all over again while talking about consumer credit, because I think there are certainly I think for some time, people have been thinking about and working on different ways of properly assessing creditworthiness, such that such that you don't replicate some of the biases that are inherent in traditional scoring models. And that's a tough conversation with weighty views on a lot of different points. But look, punchline is absolutely. I'm so glad you brought up that anecdote, because I think it rightly points to, again, this thing that we've been talking about, the difference between cryptocurrency and the technology, the desire to ensure that sensible applications, really valuable applications that have yet to be developed, are given the space to find that product market fit while protecting consumers from predation today. The other thing that you just reminded me of, in speaking over the last couple of weeks, I've had any number of conversations with various fintech founders, handful of them, diverse people of color. And one thing, many of them are committed to this notion of attacking the racial wealth gap and creating opportunities for everyone, including people of color, to participate in all, every part of the economy. And it does seem pretty clear to me that people are at least intrigued by cryptocurrency. Maybe that becomes the entry point, right? I mean, a lot of what some of the founders I speak to observe, rightly so, I think, is, hey, the average retail investor age, 22 to 33, they're probably getting further and further away from kind of the traditional online brokerage model, right? I don't know how many of those people, particularly people of color, opening up accounts with Fidelity or Merrill or JPM or what have you. But they are engaged in other ways, right? They're engaged in various forms of social media. They might be, avid Reddit consumers. Mm-hmm. They might follow various content creators. So there's kind of a broader fundamental point here that's, I think, getting away from the crypto conversation per se. But the distribution channel, the way in which people consume information and make financial decisions has changed, will continue to change, right? It will continue to be here. I don't know how many people, I don't know how many people of color will care about, books that, Suze Orman or Dave Ramsey have written, but there are plenty of other content creators that they follow. I think it's important to pay attention to that and to be open to the need to meet the retail consumer or the retail investor where they are today, which, mm-hmm. Again, may not be a traditional brokerage and it may not be in a traditional asset class. And if cryptocurrency is the hook that's required to get people interested in thinking about their financial health and thinking about, their family's financial well-being. And if we can use that, as an entry point to improve the rest of their financial lives, I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity there. There's got to be, right? I mean, for the financial well-being of many more Americans, and especially communities that have been shut out for a long time. And huge shout out to the students for, you know, bringing this thread in, and they, several of them, you know, saw it immediately and brought that up to the fore. So thank you to all those students. Another aspect, we only got a few more minutes here, but I do want to touch briefly on environmental impacts of crypto. It's a huge part of the conversation that's happening right here. And the environmental impacts of cryptocurrency mining. Quickly, do you think you could explain what cryptocurrency mining is? And then really curious about your perspective on the implications of this. You know, it's a massively energy intensive process, and that has massive environmental impacts. And so what are we going to do about it?
I don't know. Crypto mining, I'm not sure. So I will not be able to do this justice. Here is how I explain it to myself. Depending on the crypto protocol, right? But like in the case of blockchain, for example, the way, Bitcoin, for example, the way a Bitcoin is generated is essentially, by solving a math problem. I mean, this is at least how frustrated technologists have tried to explain this to me, right? When they realize my severe limitations on technological understanding, what they tell me is, look, it's, you're basically solving a really tough, a really elegant math problem, and it requires a lot of computing power, and it makes it such that it seems fairly clear that you're upside down from jump in terms of the amount of energy required to generate that one digital asset, the outcome, right? At least a handful of people believe that to be the case, understand it to be that you're upside down in terms of the cost needed to generate that value. That, obviously, if that remains true for the long term, seems problematic, as you point to a lot of reasons. Also, I think to the extent that more institutional, more larger financial institutions continue to get into crypto, there probably will be some need to better understand the environmental impacts, because those financial institutions probably have some affirmative obligations, some affirmative regulatory obligations in terms of articulating their commitments, their ESG commitments. And so what is the environmental impact of their involvement in this technology, in this asset class, in this thing? Seems mighty hard to articulate those impacts when, people are still trying to figure it out. So it does seem like quite a
kind of gets to an interesting question about, you know, classic externalities born previously by cause previously by an institution or an organization that you can at least point to. This is this, you know, distributed tech, by definition, a distributed technology. These externalities still exist, but where are they attributable? To whom are they attributable? And perhaps it will only be through involvement by institutional players that there's even an entree point into addressing these issues.
Maybe there's another point here that I think that perhaps tempers at least some of these concerns over the long haul. And that is, and this is not necessarily a novel thought. I've heard various forms of this expressed by other actual technologists. So I think it's fair to say that something like Moore's Law still exists today, and so Moore's Law, the notion that computing power essentially doubles every 24 months or so. So whether that, strictly speaking, is true today, or some version of that is true today, I have to believe that the answer is yes, right? That computing power increases at an accelerating rate, which is all to say, Maybe we won't have these same concerns, or maybe they will be tempered in 5 to 10 years' time. I don't know, right? But these are all valid questions, and we would probably do well to understand where's that convergence point, right? Where is that point at which Moore's law actually keeps up, catches up with the energy costs associated with these endeavors?
Well, I think that is a good stopping place for us. Manny, thank you so much for chatting with me today. It was great.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.